here on the podium, and particularly on behalf of Diane and myself as co-chairs of this session. Thank you very much for coming on a Sunday afternoon to discuss a very important topic to all of us. It's a pleasure for me seeing you. You know, I feel somehow ambivalent. On the one hand, I feel it's wonderful to be again, if I may say so, with the scientific community. I miss you, and it's like going back home. On the other hand, I'm with you every day because HIV-TB integration is really the challenge, and so much of the challenge in countries wherever I travel. And we can't seriously talk about scaling up if we do not address that issue as a priority. Before we start, let me thank the co-sponsoring organizations for this particular session, WHO, the HIV-TB Working Group, the Forum, Veronica is here, IAS, the Global Fund, and UNAIDS. We'll start right away, and let's keep in mind that, as I was saying, when we are scaling up interventions to serious levels, to where we are now in the epidemic, it is absolutely essential that there is TB screening and prevention in all HIV care settings. It is essential that there is access to HIV counseling and testing and to HIV care in all TB care settings. It is essential that there is infection control. I know, Kevin, you'll talk about the three I's, so that people living with AIDS can attend, and some of the staff and this can attend services without fear and without risk. It is essential that we keep a very close eye on surveillance, and that we actually increase our surveillance when it comes to drug-resistant TB among people living with AIDS. And it is essential that we mobilize beyond the public sector, the private sector, as one of the Global Fund grants does actually when it comes to DOTS delivery in India. And it's essential that we mobilize civil societies and communities in this priority effort of ours to integrate HIV and TB care for people living with AIDS. So thank you all for coming again, and let's just proceed with the session. And our first presentation is by Kevin de Kock, and it is called entitled The Three I's for HIV-TB, Intensified TB Case Finding, Isoniazide Preventive Therapy, and Infection Control for TB for People Living with HIV. Why now?
Kevin. Thank you very much, Michel. Colleagues, friends, good afternoon, and thank you for coming. And thank you to the organizers for inviting me to give this presentation. If you look at the geographical distribution of HIV-associated TB cases, it really is quite remarkable that about 80 to 85% of them are actually in sub-Saharan Africa. Almost half of all HIV-associated TB actually in just 8 countries of southern Africa that actually account for less than 2% of the world's population. In response to this, ministers of health in the SADC region actually declared an emergency, WHO some years ago formulated this 12-point collaborative policy for activities to deal with it, firstly establishing collaborative mechanisms across AIDS and TB programs, secondly looking at the issue from the point of view of the HIV-infected person, and thirdly, from the point of view of the TB patient. And it is B, decreasing the burden of TB amongst people living with HIV, that's the subject of my brief presentation. Now, from the HIV perspective, really, and from WHO's HIV work, the the declaration of commitment towards universal access made by the leaders of the G8 in 2005 really has been the sort of conscience, if you will, of our work, of our technical work. But one thing I've come to realize in the past couple of years is it's essential that we include tuberculosis under this concept of universal access. I think that has to be a bottom line. WHO tracks the health sector's progress towards universal access with an annual report that was released at the end of May this year, the second one, and it covers these various elements listed here, but importantly it also covers data on tuberculosis, some of it shared with the annual TB report, and I'll just show a quick number of data from this. I'm hoping that this particular slide will become the slide of the conference. I remember attending the really legendary conference in Vancouver 10 years ago, in 2006, 12 years ago, in 1996, 12 years ago, when John Mellors' famous slide of viral load and progression to AIDS really just dominated the various proceedings. And I'm hoping that this achievement, the global achievement of 3 million people on therapy in low and middle income countries by the end of 2007 will feature prominently also. The report, our Universal Access Report, covered a number of TB, HIV elements, and they do show progress, but progress is slow. It's not fast enough. Here you have a number of issues relating to collaborative TB, HIV activities, the dark purple 2005, the lighter purple 2006, looking at 63 priority countries, and we do see progress, but we are far from, in all of these different areas, be it establishing collaborations across the two programs, testing and counseling and so on, we are far from where we need to be. This slide shows the uptake of HIV testing in 64 countries reporting data in 2005 and 2006. The dark purple histograms refer to 11 priority African countries that make up over half of global TB-HIV. And again, you see that progress has been made over time, but we're still only testing about 35% of TB patients. It's much better in certain individual countries, but across the board, we're still lagging behind. The slide's not advancing. The slide's not advancing.
Shall I try from here?
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Okay, I'll just do
all
it
right. It wasn't working. Okay, so I think despite the huge amount of work that remains to be done, I think the TB community actually, in the last five, perhaps slightly more years, has come a long way to acknowledging the importance of HIV for TB and initiating specific activities. And I think we in the HIV community need to acknowledge that actually we have not yet met our responsibilities. And in that 12-point policy document that WHO brought out, the three areas that the HIV community has to deal with, because it is they that see the patients concerned, are what we've referred to as the three I's. And this refers to intensified case-finding for tuberculosis, isoniazid preventive therapy, and infection control. And these are really all of them issues that have received quite a lot of scientific attention, but not that much programmatic attention. And so in April of this year, a meeting was held in Geneva, bringing together HIV people particularly to discuss these elements. The recommendations that came out of it were that isoniazid preventive therapy and intensified case finding really have to become part of standard HIV care and an absolute expectation, just as access to prophylaxis with cotrimoxazole is, for example. But this will require, just wait, I'll say when to change things.
Okay.
This will require reconceptualizing some of the earlier guidelines. Isoniazid is a fascinating subject when you want to talk about putting research into practice. There have been a very large number of isoniazid preventive therapy trials, and yet almost no country has scaled this intervention up despite the important research findings. So we really do feel that this has got to be part of standard care. It will mean that we'll have to develop better algorithms for screening. It will require laboratory strengthening. Next slide, please, Michelle. Thank you. We hope that by the end of this year that the preventive therapy guidelines that do exist will be reconceptualized to bring them up to date, the current reality. And the same is true for infection control guidance. We're also going to have to develop better algorithms for intensified case finding. And we will need to develop indicators around these three elements for accountability purposes to the funders of such activities. And obviously, we will have to work on country adaptation. Next slide, please. Infection control has been an extraordinarily neglected area in low and middle income countries. It obviously requires, to bring it up to the standards that we see in the industrialized world, requires quite a lot of resources, but there's a lot of simple things that could be done, some of them 10 steps outlined in this document released by the World Health Organization in recent time. Next slide, please. So some of our next steps, I think, will have to include advocacy, and this will require both a push and a pull, if you will. We can, at WHO level and with our colleagues in the TB and HIV communities and civil society, can work on the technical aspects of this, the guidelines, the normative work. But I think there's also a need for demand creation at a societal level, mobilizing people with HIV to demand that they demand what was so effectively demanded when it came to antiretroviral therapy. For example, really demanding that isoniazid preventive therapy become part of standard care. Next slide. There are implications for procurement and supply chain management. And I think there's opportunity and need for some creative thinking, like, for example, co-packaging or even co-formulating isoniazid with cotrimoxazole. Cotrimoxazole, which again, in several clinical trials, has been shown to be so beneficial and actually life-saving in HIV-infected patients with tuberculosis, and yet whose uptake still lags behind. Next slide. At the country level, at the global level, we can make recommendations and assist with the development of training materials and toolkits and guides and so on. But it's at the country level that discussions need to be had about actually adapting these to the local level, and including, of course, raising the necessary resources, which is why it's so encouraging that both senior levels of PEPFAR and the Global Fund are represented at this symposium. Next slide. This is my final slide, and I just want to make a point that I think in the world of HIV, we really do need seriously to mainstream tuberculosis, to make this a central concern for everybody associated with HIV at any level, to adapt the concept of universal access to include TB, but also to start considering some emerging issues, including social aspects and human rights issues. I think that the protection against these major infectious diseases, malaria, TB, HIV, and the vaccine-preventable diseases need to be regarded as global public goods. I think we need to start emphasizing positive aspects of human rights now that there is so much we can offer and do, and not so much the negative rights that for good reasons were emphasized years ago. But it's essential to bring tuberculosis into this discussion, because there are many, many issues around things like infection control, the protection of healthcare workers, the right not to get infected with tuberculosis, and especially drug-resistant or extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis when you attend a healthcare setting. The picture at the top there is actually a South African picture of a guard sitting outside a hospital surrounded by barbed wire, where patients with multi-drug and extensively drug-resistant, many of them for sure HIV-infected, were being detained against their will on the grounds of public health. These are deep issues, and there are no easy answers, but this is the kind of discussion that we need to be beginning to have. And the final curve at the bottom, just to remind us, the modeled epidemic curves of the future of the AIDS epidemic, while incidence may have peaked, you see that the summary curve in the little inset of people living with HIV predicts that we're in this for the very, very long haul, just as the recently released data from the United States about stable incidence, higher than we thought, has been the situation for the last decade and seems to project into the future. So with those words, I'll close. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kevin. We will keep questions, if this is agreeable to you, too, after we hear from the first three speakers. So the second next presentation, Kevin, you talked about how to go from recommendations to programmatic issues, is Mark Naibo, the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator, and he will speak on TB prevention, diagnosis, and treatment services for people living with HIV, scale-up implications for HIV implementers. Mark.
Thank you. Thank you, Michelle. And thank you, Diane, for both of you for co-hosting this session, particularly the Global Fund's leadership funding $1.4 billion, I think, in tuberculosis programs, and Diane's leadership with the HIV-TB Working Group or Committee in WHO. And thanks to the co-sponsors. I don't have any slides, and I just want to make three simple points. And my apologies to Michelle and others who have heard me given these before. With HIV-TB, we really have fairly simple things to do. One, we need to acknowledge and promote the fact that HIV and TB have been model health care and development programs, not just health, but development as well. Two, recognize that we have an obligation to work together, the HIV and TB communities. And three, it's in our interest as HIV and TB communities to work together. In terms of the first, it is important to acknowledge, particularly in the current unfortunate circumstance of vertical and horizontal and all the other debates that we hear, to recognize and promote the fact that TB and HIV have been clear successes in global health and in development. And I think it's important that we recognize it's not just in health, but in development. TB and HIV programs have been among the most successful promoting basic development principles. Country ownership, whether it's Stop TB or HIV programs, with national strategies, with the support from multilaterals and bilaterals coming behind national strategies, whether it's the three ones for AIDS, the three I's now for tuberculosis. There's been strong promotion of country ownership, and it's a success we need to talk about. Two, and perhaps most important, there are clear successes for accountable and transparent development in healthcare, with set indicators and set goals that are measured. Now, we might be behind in some of them, but in terms of accountable and transparent development programs and health programs, TB and HIV stand out as great successes. They are also two fields in which we are constantly self-evaluating and changing. And Kevin just went over the latest edition of that for tuberculosis with the three I's. These are fundamental and important principles for health and development, and I think we need to promote more and more the clear successes, particularly in the current environment that we're in, because these principles are fundamentally the Monterey and Paris principles, and we have succeeded. The second point, that we have an obligation to work together, the HIV and TB communities. I actually would refer you to an excellent article by Diane Havler in JAMA. It's an excellent summary of the need for us to work together. But I think we fundamentally need to recognize and talk about the fact that in Africa, at least, HIV is TB, and TB is HIV. TB is the leading cause of death, as we all know, for HIV, and HIV is fueling the TB epidemic. That's the bad news. The good news is we know that if we work together, we can, in fact, tackle and solve these problems. And that's one of the reasons we have an obligation to work together, because we know by working together, we can succeed. We know from a couple of studies that we can reduce tuberculosis with effective antiretroviral therapy in HIV-positive persons. We know now from a number of countries that with intensive effort, we can have success in identifying HIV-positive people who are tuberculosis-positive as well and treating them. In Kenya, we've seen an 84% rate for TB patients tested for HIV in 2007, up from 41% only a couple years before. In Rwanda, an 88% rate of TB patients tested for HIV, up from 45% only a few years before. Through a collaboration with PEPFAR and WHO and country leadership, in Kenya, 42% of HIV-positive TB patients started antiretroviral therapy. Ethiopia, 28%, up from 19%. Rwanda, 36%, up from 13%. This is all over a couple of years, three-fold increases in key indicators. And so we know if we work together, we can succeed. It's important to have both bilaterals and multilaterals involved. As I mentioned, the Global Fund is a leader here. PEPFAR has tripled its resources for HIV-TB, nearly five-fold increase from $26 million in 2005 to $150 million this past year. Still not enough, but it's an example of how we need to be pushing forward. I think one of the problems is that we don't understand this obligation to work together. We've actually made resources available for HIV-TB and people haven't utilized them. That's a great tragedy. If money's available, it should be utilized for these important efforts. I was recently in a country that has had an excellent STOP-TB program, well, a very good STOP-TB program, a nascent HIV program. The HIV community there, including the bilaterals and multilaterals, were actually arguing against using the TB infrastructure to expand HIV programs, mostly for interpolitical reasons. That's a great tragedy. We have an obligation to work together, and we know that if we work together, we will succeed. I would also highlight the point that Michelle made, that we need all sectors engaged. This isn't just a government activity. The private sector needs to be involved for drug development and in important sectors like mining and other communities where we know HIV-TB is high. We need private foundations like the Gates Foundation and others who are doing excellent work here in drug development. We need faith-based and community-based organizations. Faith-based organizations provide 30% to 70% of healthcare in Africa. If they're not engaged, we're not going to succeed. So if we work together, we know we can succeed, and we have an obligation to do it because we'll save lives. But it's also in our interest to do it. As I mentioned, in the current cacophony of vertical, horizontal, the almost senseless debates that are occurring right now in the development and international community, if we can't, with HIV and TB work together, two diseases that are too closely linked, we are actually basically telling these critics that they're right. If we can't have so-called vertical programs of HIV-TB linked, how on earth are we going to link maternal and child health and malaria and education and gender equality and all the programs that need to be linked and leveraged and built off of? It's in our interest to do this, but more importantly, it's our obligation to do it because it will save lives. We owe it to those we are privileged to serve and to ourselves to tie HIV and TB together. So I think it's important we think big, act on the ground. It's great when we all talk together in these meetings, but fundamentally we need the communities and country to sit down and plan together and solve the issues and leverage each other. And if we do that, and if we look to the big picture, and if we have an openness of spirit to break down these bureaucratic and programmatic walls, we can actually tackle this problem. So I really appreciate the fact that you all raised this issue, and I hope we can focus on those three issues. We are a model of success in development and health. It is our obligation to work together to save lives, and it's in our self-interest to do so. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mark. Implications of these new recommendations and of what we all understand is now needed as a priority isn't just implications for implementers and for funders. It's also about advocacy and activism. So that's the title of our next presentation from Musa Njoko from South Africa. And your presentation is entitled HIV-TB for People Living with HIV, Implications for Activism and Advocacy. Musa.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Hello. Hi. How are you doing? I hope my presentation will be great. As I've been introduced, my name is Musa Njoko. I come from South Africa. I am not proud to be HIV positive, but I am also not ashamed. I am not a disgrace or embarrassment to my family. I am not a liability to my family and country, but I am an asset with so much to give.
Hold on 1 second, Musa. Can we? We have the slides here, but we don't have them on the screen. Sorry. Okay, good. Thank you. And I can change the slides whenever you tell me. Okay.
As I was saying, I am not a liability to my family and country, but I am an asset with so much to give. I am an African woman, pride of my nation. I am a woman of courage and strength. I am a mother who brings hope and love, who calms the storms of life for her children, who turns her adversity to victory. I am powerful and dynamic. I am sensible and innovative. I am wise and I am strong. I am more than a conqueror. I am a proud African Zulu woman, pride of my nation. My voice today represents voices of many women, women from South Africa, women from Africa, and women from around the world. These are women who will never be slaves again, slaves of oppression, manipulation, poverty, abuse, disease, and disrespect. Today we choose to take our rightful place, place of power, leadership, and authority. We turn the tide against HIV and TB and all those things that are holding us hostage. Spiritual bondages, cultural locks, and traditional chains. For every person here today, I challenge you to turn the tide against TB and HIV. I discovered that I was HIV positive in 1994. At the time, I was 22 years old. I was already a mother of a baby boy who is now 16. It was at the dawn of the South African liberation, 1994, political change. It was at its peak. Everything was changing. And for me, my life changed. I had HIV. That meant I wasn't going to be part of the transformation. I was told I was going to die in less than 3 months. It was devastating. Totally confusing. Other than Freddie Mercury, I was the first person I knew to be HIV positive. I had limited knowledge about HIV. There was complete absence of dialogue on this issue. My doctor told me to go home and die, denying me any care as she advised it was an incurable disease. The severe stigma caused by stereotyping and lack of knowledge made me an outcast at the church and community where I grew up. I sank into isolation, awaiting death, experiencing paralyzing frustration and anger. When death did not come 3 months later, as had been promised by the doctor, my anger took over and I rebelled against the treatment I had endured. I publicly disclosed my HIV status through a national newspaper, and suddenly I began to meet many others who had similar experiences, often worse than what I had gone through. That's like this. From disclosing my status, stigma and the results thereof flooded me and my family. For months, I was harassed and threatened by the man that had been my boyfriend, whom I know I contracted HIV from. There was no protection or any security when I went to report the case to the police. They told me he had not physically done any harm to me, and so they could not arrest him. Basically, we had to wait until he beat me or even kill me before they could do anything about it, if at all. I remember one policeman asked if I wouldn't be angry if my partner had told people he had AIDS. This was embarrassing and shameful, he said. All these reactions from the community drove me mad and fueled my rebellion and caused me to want to fight for my rights and for others that were suffering in silence. I realized that I was not a special case. There were many more, and since I continue to be involved, and since I continue to be involved in HIV programs. Being vocal and visible in the public, I saw that it was challenging their attitudes and stereotypes and providing information and knowledge. Over the years, I have learned the critical importance for us people living with the condition to be part of the discussions and be at the forefront, as others may have medical or scientific understanding, but we know the reality of what it means to live with HIV. In the absence of people living with HIV, we might end up with views which are limiting because of the limited opinion. Our lived experiences bring about a comprehensive picture, which leads me to the next point. I was HIV positive and asymptomatic for quite a few years. Also, my family became all comfortable. HIV was unreal. It was there, but invisible. There was nothing different about me, except that it was known I had it. Until in 2000, I came down with meningitis, and that's when the reality struck. It was bad, very bad. I was so shocked. It was the first time I ever got sick with an HIV-related illness. We were not prepared for this. We were all thinking this could be the beginning of the end, AIDS stage. Fortunately, in 6 months, it was treated. I was fine. And again, went back to my volunteer community work. I was an AIDS activist. My career as a musician and television personality had taken off so well. It was all good. Little did I know how real HIV was and the opportunistic infections. In 2002, I suffered from bone marrow TB. This was the biggest blow ever. Much as the infection was bad, what really drove me mad was the failure to diagnose TB in good time, because for full 3 months, I kept going to hospital telling them I was suspecting I had TB. I gave them all the symptoms I had observed, but only lung examination was done, which came back clear. And sadly, no further investigations were done until my body crumbled. I had lost so much weight from 56 kilograms to 36. And from then on, it was downhill. I was an informed HIV-positive person, but I am not a doctor or medical person. The people who should have known better let me down at that critical point of my life. I had done everything I could as an HIV-positive person. This leaves me to wonder how many lives are still lost due to TB because of this carelessness and great lack of proactiveness. I was then hospitalized in a private hospital. Thank God I had medical insurance. Number of tests were done, and only then it was discovered it was bone marrow TB. I was wheelchair bound for over 10 months. My life came to a standstill. I was psychologically messed up, not crazy, but horror struck of my reality. I was the exact picture of those people I had seen in videos and posters who had eventually died of AIDS. As a breadwinner at home, besides my mom and son, I have my sister's daughters, whom I'm responsible for since she died in 1996. When we talk to HIV-positive people in those counseling rooms, we always advise them that speak to someone, tell someone, tell your family what's going on with you. That is what I had done with my sister. She was the closest person to me. few months later, after I had disclosed to her, she killed herself by burning herself. On her suicidal note, she wrote she could not bear the fact that I was going to die and there was nothing that the family could do for me. I remember I had people that were counting on me 100%, but there was no assurance I could give them. I remember my mom once saying, "But you said this is manageable." I had no answer for my mother. My family had to endure the pain of seeing me disappearing in front of their eyes, and there was nothing they could do. Suddenly, not only HIV was real, but AIDS was a reality. Anything could happen. I could die. We had heard of thousands of people living with HIV dying of TB, and I was in line to become one of those people. I was informed, don't forget that, I had spoken to the doctors, but with the limited resources maybe and lack of information, I was not treated as should have. As a consultant, my savings went dry, and we had to live on my mom's pension. I could no longer afford expensive health care. My medical insurance had lapsed, as I could no longer pay. I had to rely on contributions from friends and extended family, which was never guaranteed. I am giving all these details just to give you a picture that maybe sometimes HIV is not an issue as much as TB is an issue for people living with HIV. My nieces had to help with the bathing, feeding, dressing, and etc. As my mom, with her poor eyesight, she could not assist me physically. My son had to be moved from a private school to a public school. This change was very hard on him, as I was not even available to support him to adjust to this change. This was a typical case of the real reality of HIV in Africa. Wow, I was treated. I survived. Thereafter, my whole family had to go for TB checkup. Fortunately, no one had it. You may call me paranoid. I did that. We had all seen what TB can do. Life was back to normal. 3 years later, 2006, after I had fully recovered and started on ARV treatment, I moved back to Durban, closed office in Joburg because the business was basically bankrupt. On my arrival in my home city 5 months later, which is in KwaZulu-Natal, I was bedridden once again. I had TB. This time around, it was even worse. It was at the outbreak of drug-resistant TB. In that period, I had once again been visiting hospital, presenting TB symptoms, but the same routine as the last time was followed. They went as far as lung checkup. Nothing deeper and beyond was ever considered. Until I suffered bed fever on Christmas Day in 2006, I was hospitalized and kept in isolation for about 3 weeks whilst tests were being done to establish what kind of TB I had. Thank God it was just normal lung TB, nothing resistant to any drug. That was a relief, though I was very weak. I was then put on treatment for 6 months until I was cured. Am I confident that I am TB free? No, I am not. I don't have the confidence in the processes, as the two past experiences of diagnosis and assessments had proven very poor. I am feeling strong and no obvious TB symptoms, but hey, you may never know. So ladies and gentlemen, do stay clear. But on a serious note, to control and stop TB, we have to look at the policies, procedures, quality of service, treatment, and accessibility. These experiences made me realize how little is being done about TB, not only in my country, but globally. Yet TB is the leading cause of death amongst people living with HIV. It is also the most common presenting illness amongst people living with HIV on ARV treatment worldwide. The burden of TB on people living with HIV is immeasurable, and it's despicable that the AIDS community has chosen to turn a blind eye on this critical issue, this injustice towards people living with HIV and affected by it. The increasing emergence of extensively drug-resistant TB and the associated mortality rate amongst people living with HIV calls for urgent action to be taken by all stakeholders, particularly HIV policymakers and service providers. Due to the lack of focus on TB and the relationship with HIV, communities are struggling to deal with it. Stigma and stereotypes is further fueling the spread of TB and failure to treat. Back at home in South Africa, especially in KwaZulu-Natal, there is now a perception that if you have TB, it means you have HIV. So TB is now being used as a diagnostic measure for HIV. And as people are in any case reluctant to know their HIV status, this drives them even further away from seeking medical help, and only to find that these people may not even be HIV positive, but probably now exposing persons living with HIV to TB at home or in the workplace. It is now also believed that you cannot be put on TB treatment if you are HIV positive and on ARV treatment. The limited access to correct information and services is leading people to create their own theories. Not that nothing at all is being done. Challenges is that from the stakeholders, service providers, donor agencies and policymakers, there seems to be great passion for HIV, but not TB, which in my view needs radical action and response now. The further delay in responding to TB and its challenges is going to cause immense damage on people living with HIV and communities affected by it, and a huge setback on successes that have been achieved over the years regarding HIV work. Failure to educate communities and providing services, and most importantly, making them accessible, will lead to more deaths of people living with HIV and increasing the impact of HIV. There needs to be more passion and focus on TB, not neglecting HIV, as the previous speaker said. There needs to be collaboration between HIV and TB communities. But we need to look at the relationship and comprehensive response. Urgent advanced training and education for healthcare workers on TB and HIV and specialized services on this matter are required. Urgent research on pregnant women living with HIV. As we may have seen, more and more pregnant women suffer with TB during pregnancy, and we need to look at the implications on TB on the mother and the baby. Urgent accessibility of advanced current technology systems and equipment to diagnose TB without further waiting and delays. Also, still talking about what can be done, we need urgent TB prevention programs that can assist in combating the spread of TB as well as HIV and thereof treating. Treatment availability and accessibility today. First, I would like to also commend the sponsors of, or rather the organizers of this session, because at this time of the HIV pandemic, this issue is quite imperative. We need to develop leadership skills and enable people living with HIV to speak up, challenge and inform policies and decisions, and be part of the TB response as we continue to do with HIV. As part of my contribution, I have a poster that I would like to show you. As part of my contribution, having lived through the experience as a mother, I have put together this campaign which seeks to dispel myths and wrong information about TB and HIV and raising awareness on the issue and providing education. The main message really is TB is curable even if you are HIV positive. Generally, in my community back home in South Africa, once you are HIV positive, people generally think it cannot be treated. You are right at the end. So the poster seeks to do that. I'm going to ask Sabelo and Rosette just to lift up the poster. This is an intervention aimed at people living with HIV, encouraging them to seek medical help, but now it must be made available. The poster it has a number of elements to it. It's a poster, DVD, CD, and public events and workshops. The campaign is centered around me in this case, but it's something that can also be translated to a country context. The poster has a picture of me and the story. It really just says TB is curable even if you're HIV positive. And then it talks that I have had TB. I was treated because I took my treatment as advised by medical healthcare workers, and I have been cured of TB, which I think is a critical message that we need to send out to communities to say TB is preventable, TB is curable, even if you are HIV positive. Well, as a diamond with many facets, I am not only an HIV AIDS activist, but I also sing. And I would like to sing you the song which I wrote at a time when I was very, very sick. And it is a song that I wrote really just talking to my son. It's definitely not going to show up on the screen. I cried like a baby till I couldn't cry no more. Friends are all gone and I'm here alone. My body is so weak, I've got no strength to carry on. Please, don't you walk away. You are all that I have. Each morning I go down on my knees and I start to pray. Tears rolling down my face. It seemed like words are bouncing back to me. Oh Lord, won't you hear my cry? Oh my baby little boy, don't you cry no more. Mommy has to go now. People will talk, say hateful things, walk like a hero of war. No matter what they say, my baby, walk like a hero of war. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Musa, for sharing your story with us and for the powerful message you delivered, coming back to what I was saying earlier about how much we need beyond our public sector activities to join all together in that effort. We now have a little time for discussion on these three presentations, and please come to the microphone, do identify yourselves, and ask your questions.
Hi there. I'm Matt Kavanaugh from the Results Educational Fund in the U.S. Thank you all for putting together this event. It's an important one. I wanted to...
Could you please speak slowly somehow?
Yes.
Because there is, from Trend. Where we sit, at least, it's the same for all colleagues. There's a sort of echo and the sound turns and returns to you somehow as a boomerang. Yeah.
Often, yes. So thank you for all of the great work that you've profiled thus far. I think we're seeing some really good beginnings of scale up on TB, HIV, and as Mark was saying, just a beginning, but really, really some good progress. I am concerned, however, about the extent to which the HIV community is still failing on TB.
Yeah, okay.
And as Ms. Njoko said, people living with HIV who are still dying of TB. And one area that seems glaring, Mark mentioned many of the increased testing of people in TB settings for HIV. But as far as we can tell, that same thing is not happening in HIV settings, that we're actually screening people for TB. So I wonder if you could speak to that and what kind of what the barriers are moving forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin or Mark? Kevin, would you take this?
I think there's a number of reasons. And so the question, if I understand it correctly, is although we're doing better with getting TB patients tested for HIV, why are we continuing to do so badly getting HIV patients screened for tuberculosis? Correct? I think there's a number of reasons for it. One, we have not yet succeeded, and I don't know why, because the first time that the association between these two diseases was documented in the literature, apart from in case reports, the first epidemiologic sort of data, as far as I remember, I think I'm correct, was about 1986. So this, I mean, that's over 20 years ago. That's 22 years ago, and there were many, there was already data before that, talking about case series and so on. We have not managed to get the HIV community to feel TB, and I don't really know why. I think then there are technical reasons as well, that we haven't done well with screening algorithms, diagnostic algorithms. It's a lot easier to do a rapid HIV test than it is to deal with the difficulties of tuberculosis diagnosis, you know, even pulmonary, let alone extrapulmonary. Those are some reasons, but I think others on the panel may wish to comment. Mark, what do you think as a clinician?
Well, I actually think there's a real bureaucratic, I wouldn't say political, but issue between communities, and that people are afraid of certain things, and I think there's some fear in the HIV community about TB. There's certainly been concern in the TB community about HIV overwhelming it. I really do believe there's almost a psychological component that we need to break down, in addition to the real clinical medical issues of diagnosing TB and HIV settings. So, as I mentioned, we made money available for TB and HIV settings, and it hasn't been used. So part of it is psychological. Part of it is expertise. There are a lot of HIV people who don't know much about tuberculosis, and we need to do a better job of educating them and bringing it along. I think we have an awful lot of work to do. The good thing is we are seeing success where we concentrate in WHO, and we focused on this. The Global Fund is trying to get people who are applying for HIV and TB grants to link them. But I think it really gets to getting to the ground level to force national plans for how they work together rather than more high-level things, because it's got to be done on the ground, and unless the people are talking to each other, it's not going to happen.
Yes, I'd just like to emphasize one of the points Mark made, which is, yes, funds are available, and yet that verticalization between programs still is very strong. TB programs have been in place for many, many years, and they're usually been very strong, independent, vertical. And then HIV programs came in and had to sort of fight their way, and also tended to be very vertical, and that created a basic difficulty in having the two bridge together and communicate. As you may know, the Global Fund would only accept an HIV proposal to come to us if it has a TB component, and would only accept a TB proposal to come to us if it has an HIV component, unless people really explain why they wouldn't have the second component in the proposal. So there are lots of measures we're trying to take, all of us funders, to help bridge between the two, but there's still a way to go. Diane?
I think just one other comment. I think everyone would acknowledge that when the rollout started, the logistics of getting ARV programs launched and in place were absolutely enormous, and people were very focused on, if we don't get this going, people are going to die immediately. And now, as we're transitioning to, this is a disease of decades, people are now realizing that TB is a very important part of that management, and incorporating diagnostic algorithms when people walk in the door is starting to happen. And then, as we just saw, you can get TB more at once. Screening for people along the way is starting to happen. So I completely agree with the person who answered the question that we have a long way to go, but I think we're going to start seeing this. The HIV programs take a lot more ownership of this. And I think Ruben Granich and the leadership that he's shown with the WHO, with Charlie and the Three Eyes initiatives, is going to really carry this forward.
Please go ahead. Sorry.
My name is Chester Morris, Orem Institute in South Africa. I just have a specific question about the IPT component.
Do go slowly. It's very difficult for us to hear.
Sorry, the IPT component of the Three Eyes. I've had a recent experience in two large programs in South Africa and Nigeria, two countries where there is current policies on INH use. And my experience in those programs, an experience that we had, was intense provider-level opposition to the use of INH. And this was, you know, even an experienced, you know, clinicians, even infectious disease specialists in some cases. So in terms of the Three Eyes strategy and the IPT, I heard the demand component. In terms of the supply component, is there going to be a focus on providers? Because, like I say, in some large programs that I've had experience in, the provider has been a key block in actually the provision of INH.
It's about Three Eyes. Preventive treatment on these Three Eyes.
You know, it's almost impossible up here to hear. I heard about a third of your question.
Oh, sorry.
Not
okay.
Clear. It's not going to be any clearer.
So just specifically about the INH provision?
Could you come to the front and repeat your question? Yeah. Why don't you come to the front?
Yeah, what I suggest is that, indeed, people come here, ask, be kind, come here, ask the question, and the one person on the panel who is answering will repeat the question in the microphone so that everyone can hear, because we just can't understand what you're saying.
Sure.
Would you, I'm sorry, but do please come here. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So in terms of the Three I strategy,
yes.
I understand you're three demand, but on the supply side, it's going to keep up the key block and issue the provider, even trying to trade position, not giving up.
Yes, yes.
Even though they understand.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the question is, in the speaker's experience, an obstacle to the provision of isoniazid preventive therapy has often been the medical profession, the providers who resist this, even infectious disease trained physicians. So how does one deal with this? And it's all good and well to create demand, but how do you deal with that provider issue? Perhaps I could have a first stab at it. I mean, I think this is exactly the sort of area that bodies, normative bodies like the World Health Organization, need to take on. I think WHO, being an evidence-based organization with its convening ability, its ability to convene people from countries, I think can push to have affected countries re-examine this and really use moral persuasion as well as technical data. The technical data that really support this very strongly. I mean, how many more controlled trials do we need before we say, okay, the reduction in incidence in people at least with a positive skin test is 60%, people untested with tuberculin, it's about 40%. I mean, how many more trials do we need? So I think that's the way to go. There'll be resistance, but in some places it'll change, and I think, you know, one at a time.
Thank you. So would you mind coming here? Let's try with the microphone close to us. We'll hear you as you speak in the microphone, and everyone in the room will hear you through the microphone.
Okay, can everyone hear me?
Yes,
all right.
Reasonably.
My name is Paula Kukiziwe. I'm from the AIDS and Rights Alliance for Southern Africa. And I just wanted to make a comment on the issue of creating community demand for TB HIV action. In our experience, we work with a lot of HIV groups around the region, and one of the main reasons for a reluctance to engage in advocacy around the three I's is the lack of a common understanding and consensus when it comes to a lot of the fundamental issues underpinning the three I's. When it comes to TB HIV advocacy, it sometimes gets frustrating because it feels like there's more debate than consensus, especially with IPT, for example. No one questions the efficacy of it, but activists want to know, if we're going to advocate for this, how much can we rely on current screening tools to exclude active TB, when we often hear that they routinely fail to diagnose TB in people living with HIV? You know, what is the risk of INH resistance? How effective are standard first-line regimens where INH resistance occurs? There's a lot of data on this, but a lot of it is conflicting. And I just think if we really want to generate some advocacy, it's important to clarify all the differences, because people need to understand the implications of what they're advocating for. And right now, there's just more confusion than understanding. Yeah.
Thank you.
Who wants to
comment? Musa?
Okay. Do you want to do it?
It was basically at the community level where blacks
understand.
Yeah. I think that's a very... So the comment was one of the frustrations that activists have to the plea for, you know, community involvement, community demand generation and so on, is the lack of clarity around the three I's, the lack of technical clarity, the lack of clear messages about things like, well, you know, what about the risk of isoniazid resistance? What are the best screening algorithms? What about first-line anti-tuberculous regimens if there is INH resistance and so on? And I think that's I think that's extremely well put. In fact, I thought you said it so well that you should write it down and give it to us. Because I think you're right. I think we... In a way, we've gotten a little ahead of ourselves. I think that's okay. We've gotten a little bit ahead of ourselves saying we need to do this, but we haven't quite, you know, it's what in parts of the United States they describe as all hat and no cattle. we're talking about it, but actually we haven't got all the ducks lined up technically. But I think there's a commitment to do this. We're gonna do the... refashion the guidance on isoniazid preventive therapy and so on. On the other hand, I think we need to be realistic. We didn't have all the information when we started ART scale up either. So I think Jerry wanted to say something.
I would just add, you know, we don't know a lot of things, as Kevin said, and that's part of the problem. But everyone's pointing at each other. The HIV community is pointing at the TB community, and the TB community is pointing at the HIV and saying, you do it. And no one's actually, in a lot of places, sitting down to work it out. And also, there's also a lack of understanding about the best way to do it. Diane's article talks about this. I mean, do you build off the TB programs or do you build off the HIV program? Fact of the matter is, it doesn't matter. Build out of whatever you can to get it done. And until the communities talk to each other, they'll work through these issues, but people have to sit down and talk about it. And I think the community can be very helpful in forcing that dialogue.
Please. Does Jerry want to say something?
Hi there. Sue Perez with Treatment Action Group. I've been working really closely on the International Health Partnership, which is an initiative trying to fulfill on the Paris Declaration and to help support countries to reach the health MDGs. And I had two questions. One is partly based on my impression of WHO. So I guess my first question is directed to Kevin. It seems that WHO is very vertical. And in terms of the IHP, you know, within WHO, it's housed within the health systems cluster. So I just wonder, with all the evidence and the information that you have been gathering from the field in terms of how TB-HIV integration works, how are you and the Stop TB department within WHO feeding that information to the health systems cluster so that that kind of conversation doesn't get lost in the whole discussion around health system strengthening? The same thing goes at the country level, where health sector coordinating teams are talking about developing a revised national health plan with a budget, really focusing a lot on health systems. But as we know, the health MDGs also include six, which is AIDS, TB, and malaria. And so the WHO representatives in the countries, how are they contributing to that process of developing that national revised health plan to ensure that TB integration, TB-HIV integration, and the lessons learned and best practices from that is also helping to support the process and all the also the conversations and how that plan is actually designed. So two-part question, and I know that Paul's over here, so perhaps he can answer from the TB department side, but, you know, I really, you know, if there's anything that I can support in terms of the vertical departments within WHO to help support you all to ensure that that evidence is brought up in these discussions, you know, I would love to have that conversation with you, because right now I'm serving as a civil society rep and trying to generate a civil society agenda and mobilize that across the global community, civil society, and also at the country level. So thank you.
I'm going to ask Mark Dybul to answer that question. Again, that question is as eloquent as the previous one. We don't have answers for it. I think one of the things we have to accept as reality is that there is no structure that's perfect. And even with the best will in the world, if you're in different departments, be it at a country level or at a big organizational level, if you're in a different department, it takes superhuman effort to really work together well, and there will still be misunderstandings. And we live this, and I mean, I think the relationship between HIV and TB at WHO is very good and very close, but they are different departments, and we see this played out at country level as well. I think with the health systems agenda, we face even bigger problems, because these debates about health system strengthening vis-à-vis the disease-specific programs are very recent, and we don't have a lot of the data. We do have some, and I fully support what Mark said in his comments. But we're just beginning to gather the data more systematically. A lot of what is said in these discussions is personal opinion. I am very worried that this system, this discussion about systems, which is literally beginning to dominate global health discussion, is extremely theoretical and very non-practical. And, you know, we've had that for 20, 30 years. I mean, what we need is discussions about health systems that provide services for diseases that have names, that affect people, you know, with families. We need that specificity to these health systems discussions. And the only way I can see it going forward is by dissecting what are the components of a health system, the human resources, the management supply chains, the laboratory capacity, the infrastructure, etc., the management. And looking at those individually and tagging on the disease-specific elements, that's the way I would like to see this discussion go forward. We do talk to people in the health systems cluster at WHO. We do talk. At country level, I'm afraid I'm not in a good position to know what's happening at country level, but I think, you know, people like yourself involved in this discussion have a lot to offer, and please do it, because it is at country level these discussions are needed.
Thank you. Let's take two more questions. Right. Jerry, you also wanted to say something? So three, and then we'll move to the rest of the session. Thank you.
I'm Gabriel Mahasi. I'm Gabriel
Mahasi. All difficult questions are directed to Kevin. That's the way we set the session.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm Gabriel Mahasi. I'm training as a medical student at a teaching hospital in Kenya. This is a teaching hospital that has had quite a huge case burden of TB and HIV, so I've had a chance to see quite a number of these patients. And my question is, the available diagnostic methods at teaching hospitals in such resource-poor settings are chest X-ray, tuberculin skin test, smear testing, that is for acid-fast bacilli that cause the TB, and probably culture, which culture we know takes a lot of time before the results are out. I'm not surprised by what Mr. Njoko is saying from South Africa, that they took so long before they could diagnose TB of the bone marrow, because we do not have facilities really, or if they are there, they are quite expensive, so they cannot be employed in routine testing of extrapulmonary TB. So the smear testing, we know up to 51% of patients in Kenya on TB treatment are smear negative. And for the radiological test, that's the chest X-ray, to be significant, the patient has to have pulmonary TB. That means a lot of extrapulmonary TB is treated on the basis of anecdotal information, on the basis of, it's largely empirical, so to speak. Someone would come in probably with meningitis that is unresponsive to antibiotics. Then after some time of treatment with antibiotics, someone thinks this could be TB meningitis. So we begin the person on TB meningitis treatment. Like the way she's saying, TB of the bone marrow, probably the most sensitive thing in such situations would be culture of the bone marrow aspirate to detect the presence of TB bacilli in the bone marrow. But that takes a lot of time, and it's not readily available in our setup. So my question is there a chance that the people who are finding all these programs in healthcare systems like in Kenya and many other African settings can allocate much more funds to avail better diagnostic techniques, better diagnostic tools to such setups so that extrapulmonary TB can be picked up at an earlier stage and be amenable to treatment rather than later on in the stages of the disease, at which morbidity and mortality is much higher. The second question is, the IPT, isoniazid preventive therapy, has been touted as a modern way of helping people to, or rather stopping the progression of the disease to the severe forms of TB. So IPT, isoniazid preventive therapy, has been really brought forward and advocated for as something that should be practiced much more regularly than before. But with the emergence of multi-drug resistance TB and extreme drug resistance TB, is it still a viable thing to do? Is it still something that you'd advocate for to be rolled out on large scale, as probably other speakers would have advocated for? Thank you.
Thank you for your questions, and it's wonderful to hear someone who's working with the patients and to point out what some of the biggest obstacles are. There's absolutely no doubt among the field and among the funders that our diagnostic tools right now for TB are really in the stone ages, that it's dramatically hurting our patients. When you can only diagnose 50% of the patients with pulmonary TB by a smear, and most places don't even have the facilities to do a smear, we are in very deep trouble. I'd like to assure the person who answered the question, this is very, very, the improvement of diagnostics for TB is extremely high on the global agenda for tuberculosis. A great amount of resources, although not enough, are being put into this, and the focus is really to develop rapid diagnostic tests and even PCR-based ones that can be used in exactly the setting where you work. I'd also like to deflect the question to another aspect that we all are involved in, all the HIV movement. One of the ways to diminish the proportion of people who suffer from disseminated TB, which is extremely difficult to diagnose, is to find people earlier in the course of HIV disease so they never progress medically to the point where they develop disseminated TB. And I think we all need to keep this in mind as we are developing global strategies. So once again, I'm sorry that I didn't address, maybe some of the other panelists want to address some other things, but I want to thank you for your excellent questions.
Jerry?
I think all of the panel members have basically said what I was wanting to say. Let me just summarize one or two things and then add one additional thing. So I think we talk about integration as if you just put two things together and they integrate. And it really is an evolutionary process because the worlds are very, very different. And I think those of us who've worked in each understand that. So that we have to be, although there's a tremendous urgency, we also have to be a little tolerant of the process by which things come together, and not forget that it's urgent, but also I think this is a wonderful opportunity at this meeting and among the first, actually, that this kind of discussion takes place in an HIV meeting and continue to do that. But I also want to say that when you talk about integration, it's really on the ground very heterogeneous. There isn't a single way of integrating because these programs now have either a long history, tuberculosis, or a short but very intense history, HIV, and each circumstance in each country and within each country, urban, rural, township, rural, KwaZulu-Natal, are very, very different. They're different than resources, expertise, will, commitment, training. So there has to be some flexibility in the integration process that really takes into account a whole array of different models. And I think we have to learn how to be flexible in terms of the integration from collaboration, integration. The last thing I wanted to say, because it hasn't come up in this discussion, is to reemphasize the I that usually still gets forgotten, and that's infection control. And that's an issue that people put on the list but then don't talk about. And this is another example of it. And this is critical in areas of high HIV and TB prevalence. And I think we all appreciate the risk of transmission of TB within the HIV setting, not only the identification of TB within the HIV setting, but the risks to other people and how that has to be addressed. And it's a combination of training but also structure, because the facilities that are available for most infection control in most settings are really so abysmally poor that it makes it almost impossible to do it. So we have to think really very creatively about how to do simple infection control practices within the context of how we work in sub-Saharan Africa. So we shouldn't omit infection control because it's so problematic, but really struggle with how to identify ways of making it possible.
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry, for those points. And I think your point on flexibility is well taken. And from experience, as we travel to countries, we see many, many different examples. And I think that flexibility should somehow help us not delay things too much because it offers a broad scope of possibilities. The last question, please.
Thank you very much for the last question. My question is very short. First comment, the last message, the story of Nady from South Africa, give us the message that TB is curable even you are HIV positive. I would like to ask more one word, preventable. In terms of the prevention, come to the question. I'm looking expert around the room, and Professor Paul Noom from WHO. So the story, tell me, there was an opportunity to prevent the second TB of the lady or not? Because we have evidence of IPT for the people not yet the TB disease, but now they are already curable, accused of TB. So IPT can provide for the people already treated for TB successfully. Thank you.
In terms of the second part of your question, secondary isoniazid prophylaxis, that is to say, after you've had one episode of TB, trying to prevent the next episode, there's two randomized controlled studies that demonstrated that INH was beneficial in this setting. One of the things that we do not know is in the era of antiretroviral therapy, whether isoniazid will show a similar benefit. There are epidemiologic data would suggest that perhaps it will, but that remains an open-ended question. But I think the questionnaire's point of that we need to make sure in terms of our programs developing approaches to TB that consider not only they need to consider prevention, treatment and diagnosis, but also reinfection. And reinfection in the setting of perhaps infection control need to be a part of the programs. Thank you. I think we'll move on to our next speaker. There's been quite a bit of reference to what's happening at the country level and what do we know and what are some of the challenges there. And I'm pleased to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Chidiwadakorn, who works in the Department of Disease Control and the Ministry of Public Health in Thailand. Dr. Chidiwadakorn has worked for many years in some unique approaches to integrating diseases, HIV, TB, and STIs, and he's paid particular attention to the private sector, which is something we have not talked about yet, and civil society. So we appreciate you coming to join us and look forward to your insights on the country level.
So thank you for the very nice introduction. So I just would like to begin with the situation of HIV and TB in Thailand. As you can see from this slide that approximately about 80% of the HIV patients in Thailand are transmitted through sexual transmitted route. And if you look at the most common OI, you can see that approximately about 30% of the cases were having tuberculosis. In Thailand, we have about 63 million population, and we are also one of the 22 high tuberculosis burden countries, with an estimation of about 90,000 cases of TB patient in every year. And also we estimated that we already have 1.1 million people infected with HIV, of which half of them has already died. The 100% coverage of that implementation has implemented since 2003, and you can see that in general about 0.9% of our pregnant women has HIV. Anyway, the latest development is that antiretroviral therapy services are now accessible to all people who are living HIV in Thailand at the district level, which means that every public hospital in Thailand, about 1,000 hospitals in Thailand, are now providing antiretroviral therapy free without any charge to the patient in Thailand. And this is some occasion of TB HIV implementation. We heard a lot of discussion, but this is what really happened in Thailand. Actually, there are some activities happened before this, but this is the major development. In 2003, we piloting some TB HIV activities in Thailand with the support from the USA and from the CDC corporation sites. 2004, we have developed a national guideline for TB and HIV collaborative activities. And also in the same year, we have established what we call the National TB HIV Committee that trying to promote TB and HIV collaboration. And in 2005, we start to pilot TB HIV activities in small scales. And after that, after we learn some mistake and some lesson learned, we revise. In the same year, we also started to try to revise record and reporting form so that we know what happened in our TB patient. So 2 years ago, we started to implement our TB HIV activities countrywide. And this is some target that we set at the beginning in the 2006. So for example, we set the target of having HIV testing in all TB patients starting at 75% in 2006. And we hope that by the end of 2009, more than 90% of TB patients should be screened for HIV. Antiretroviral treatment, at least 50% in the first year, 2006, of TB patients should be treated with antiretroviral. And in 2009, more than 60%. The one of the three I's, the intensified tuberculosis test finding, we set the target at 80% in 2006, and we hope that in 2009 should be more than 90%. And this is just some example of what we create, or what is the form that we newly introduced for the TB and for the TB patients, so that we could know what happened in our TB patients. I'm not going into detail. And this is just what the outcome of our TB HIV activities in the year 2006 and 2007. And you can see from this slide that the HIV testing in TB patients increased from 52% in 2006 to 68% in 2007. And also the potamoxazole prevention therapy for tuberculosis patient also increased from 64% to 67%. The it's not so good achieved was the antiretroviral. We set the target of more than 60%, but we still have 32%. The major achievement, I think we have developed a good guidelines for TB HIV collaboration, and also for EITC, for antiretroviral therapy for TB and HIV patient. We also incorporate the TB HIV monitoring indicator into our routine TB register form. And the good things is that now our new TB register form has been adopted by our health district hospital, and you can see from this slide that almost more than 90% of them start to report the figures back to Thailand, so we know what happened in our TB patient. And as I just mentioned, we could increase our HIV testing in tuberculosis patient from 52% in 2006 to 68% in 2007. And the high coverage of ICF, I put a question mark here because we still could not collect the number from the nationwide, but I have an example of one region. In 2007, it was reported more than 90% of the new cases of HIV new diagnosed cases has received ICF. And that is a good sign. This is just an example of how we try to promote what we call the PITC. We have many models. For example, the model ones, the pretest for PITC would be done in the TB clinic. And if the HIV is negative, the TB clinic will look after those patients. But for TB patients who have HIV positive, they will refer to the HIV clinic. This is one of the first model in Thailand. The second model has a different, that the TB patient will be screened and will be looked after by the HIV clinic, even regardless the HIV status. And in some model, the P-test will start at the HIV clinic, and then it depends on the serial status of the patient. If the HIV is negative, then the TB clinic will take over, for example. So right now, I think the first model it is what we recommended, and it just has been published in the International Tuberculosis Lung Diseases in this year, that the best model for PITC is the first model which started at the TB clinic, and the TB clinic will screen for the HIV. If the HIV is negative, the TB clinic will carry on and look after that patient. And once the HIV is positive, then the patient will be referred to the HIV clinic. But however, there are still some different models going on in Thailand. This is the example of one region. It's in the northeastern part of Thailand that you can see from this slide that the services in 2007, the first to perform PITC, 97 of them were performed in the TB clinic, only 3% in HIV clinic and in other health facility. And the staff who provide TB and HIV care in the TB HIV integrated services, you can see that the same person, about 25%, different person but from the same section, about 40%, and different person from different section, about 35%. So in general, about more than 25% are from same person or in the same section, and about 1/3 from different section. And when you look at the detail of the service, you can see that most of them, about 82% of this district hospital in this region, has already established what we call TB HIV team, so that the TB HIV service could be more cooperation than what happened in the past when they have two separate team. And the staff who provide PITCT, you can see that the TB staff 52%, HIV staff 16%, and both 28%. So now there are lots of major challenges, and the most important one, I think, is the lacking of the joint planning together between the TB and HIV program at all level, and we just heard many opinion from the floor that there are still lack of planning. And the other very important is that the we still have the other two I that we still could not achieve, that is the TB infection control. And also the other one is the IPT, because there are still we need more strong evidence, and we heard about reinfection, or we heard about drug resistance. So I think there are still a lot of things going on, and the low uptake of the antiretroviral in the TB HIV patient. So far, we could achieve only about 35%, and we set the target as more than 60%. So we still need to speed the antiretroviral in the TB HIV patient. And I think this is the last line. I think what Thailand has been achieved, because we have many technical and financial assistance, and the government has really commit to both TB and HIV, and we have the World Health Organization for financing and technical support. And lastly, we have the also the Global Fund that start initiative work for TB and HIV services. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Thank you for sharing your progress and your challenges, and seeing infection control up on the challenge is just a testimony to the cutting edge of your program. Our final speaker for today is Dr. Paul Nunn, I'm sure whom many of you know. Paul has worked on the field, done some pivotal work on HIV and TB epidemiology early in his career, and now really has taken a global leadership role in HIV and TB, and most recently has taken a leadership role in the MDR and XDR epidemic. This afternoon, he is going to focus on country implementation, and the title of his talk is Commentary on Country Implementation, What Are the Triggers?
Well, good afternoon, and I will be as quick as I can for those of you who want to get away from the opening session, opening ceremony. What I'm really presenting is a non-systematic review of what has enabled those countries who've made progress in TB-HIV to make that progress. So if you are a firm addict of systematic reviews and evidence-based medicine, you can go to the opening ceremony now. This is just to introduce very quickly the fact that we are making progress in TB-HIV activities across the board, as Mark Dybul very nicely pointed out. So year on year there is progress, but still we are a long way from achieving our goals, both on the TB side, if you like, and in the three columns on the right there, on the HIV side of the equation, as Kevin pointed out earlier. We didn't go into the details and the numbers of that slide. But one enabler which many countries have pointed out is that the policy seen internationally was clear. And this, I think, has enabled a number of countries perhaps to move a little quicker than they might otherwise have done. And this is the so-called interim TB-HIV policy on collaborative activities. And again, we needn't go through each of these lines, but one important enabler is to make sure that at international level, the policy is clear. And I actually think that although there are a number of details that need to be sorted out in a number of areas, enough is known already for us to make serious progress at country level on IPT, on infection control, and on intensified case finding. That's in response to Paula's previous question. I think it was Robert Louis Stevenson who said that leadership is the art of making decisions in the absence of complete data. And it may be that what's required in countries is leadership. Now, moving on to those critical enablers at national level. I mean, one thing that's clear is that things don't happen unless there is communication and interaction, usually between the program managers of the National TB Program and the National AIDS Control Program. It's so blindingly obvious, but nevertheless, that is clear, clearly a problem if you don't have it. However, communication interaction alone are not enough. What needs to be there as well is a mutual appreciation of the scale of the problem and a determination to address it. A number of countries, I think, have been put off by some of the obstacles that they've encountered. We recommended in the original policy that there be TB-HIV focal points pointed at national level and as far down the regional and district level as you can. And that certainly seems to have worked in a number of countries, particularly in Kenya, for example. Again, not much would have happened without the wave of additional financial resources that came with the Global Fund and with PEPFAR. So it's a great shame that the heads of those two agencies have had to go for the opening ceremony. But it wasn't just a question of money. The technical advice and resources and so forth were also quite important, not just from WHO, but from other partner agencies as well. And that has certainly stimulated a number of countries. And I'm thinking, for example, of Nigeria and Kenya. Each country then needs to establish its, what we've called here, its own conducive policy environment. Again, many countries have found it very important to set their own national targets and define their own national plans. Kenya and Nigeria, again, are examples. And on the right-hand side here, we have some of the documents these documents here are from Rwanda. The country needs to develop its own national TB-HIV policy. That, again, is kind of obvious, but it certainly helps enormously if that formulation of policy is carried out in a participatory manner involving all those stakeholders who are likely to be involved in its implementation. And particularly civil society has been really quite important in this role. And then making sure that once the policy is established, it doesn't just sit on managers' desks, but is actually disseminated. And that involves, of course, training programs and process. It will, of course, also mean that the individual TB and HIV technical manuals, guidelines, and so forth will need to be revised. And that is quite a heavy and, it's hard work, but needs to be done. One of the key things on the TB side has been HIV testing. This is really the gateway to the services on the TB side. And Kenya, I think, has really taken the lead in this regard, and their document on guidelines for HIV testing is on the right-hand side of the slide. But the policy on provider-initiated counseling and testing has clearly been a major facilitator in terms of making HIV testing available. And many countries have decided to move towards HIV testing to TB suspects, who are very likely to have HIV, as well as TB patients. Rapid testing has been absolutely key, particularly if it can be done by the health provider in the same room. Although, as we've heard, Thailand has a number of different ways of doing it. But certainly in the protest projects in Malawi and in Zambia, the introduction of rapid testing increased the amount of testing in TB suspects by 4 or 5-fold. The Kenyan guidelines even go so far as to say that not offering HIV testing to persons presenting with HIV-associated illness, including TB, is substandard care and should be sanctioned. Another fundamentally important thing for countries, but also very important for us in WHO, who have to try and watch what's going on in the world, is the revision of recording and reporting, and making sure that when policies are changed, when implementation is changed, what is done is actually recorded and reported. And that involves putting in TB components in HIV registers and HIV components in TB registers. This has involved now quite some discussion at country and international level on harmonizing the ways in which this data is collected, so that data that comes up to WHO or the Global Fund or PEPFAR is actually the same data. And we've actually begun, and Christian Gunneberg and my team has been leading the charge on this. We now realize that all these three organizations are getting different sets of numbers with different denominators. And so there's really some serious work to be done in harmonizing this, which, of course, will be significantly assisted by having internationally recommended tools and registers to make sure that it is standardized. And then finally, but perhaps more importantly, making sure that all the stakeholders are involved and engaged and communities are mobilized. Many countries have found it very important to be supported by their PEPFAR, by their Global Fund interlocutors at country level. And if they are TB-HIV skilled and informed, so much the better. Similarly, assistance from NGOs has been fundamental in a number of countries. People living with HIV, members of the HIV community, have really provided major pressure, major stimulus for action in countries like Kenya, Tanzania too, and I'm sure other countries as well. And it's that generation of demand and the push and the shove by affected communities that I think has really been very important. Intensive, continuous training, constant supervision is essential. You can't make real progress without it, as well as making sure that the supply chain of all the necessary commodities is fully in place. And there's nothing more demoralizing than starting off providing ART TB patients only to run out of drugs. And If you have been, thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Paul. I think now with the late hour in the opening session, we are going to close this session. And I wanted to close the session with some words that I heard from Musa during her story. Musa, thank you for sharing your very personal story with us and making what we're talking about today very real. Some people going through what you've gone through would just go on their merry way. Instead, you've gone out and you've challenged us to, quote, turn the tide against HIV and TB. And Kevin, in his usual way, slipped in a sentence I'd like to share with you before we go, is that we need to turn words into action. So that's the charge of this group. That's the charge of this meeting. There's many HIV-TB activities at this meeting, and there's some materials outside. Thank you for joining us today, and I hope the rest of the meeting goes well.